Welcome to As We Speak, a conversation podcast that was hosted by saxophonist, composer, and icon of the music David Sanborn from 2023 until his passing in May of 2024. David had recorded episodes in anticipation of a new season, including the one you're about to hear with writer and musician James McBride. The conversation touches on McBride's work and admiration for David, their shared musical passions, and so much more. Please enjoy part one of the conversation.
You never know how stuff's going to turn out because, you know, our lives, you know, all of our lives just intersect in weird different ways. And all of a sudden people are this or that, or they disappear, you know, and you know, so I kind of followed at a distance some of your trajectory from like, oh, this book's a hit. And then like, holy shit, you know, and then this happens and then this happens and it snowballs. And now, you know, here we are with, you know, the Heaven and Earth grocery store. And it's like, wow, you know, and I think being the age that I am to have seen, you know, various people's paths through their lives and, you know, people either disappear or they, you know, they come into their own and in different ways. And, you know, it was just, you know, it's like, you know, what Bill and I said to each other, it's nice when good people make it, you know?
Well, I mean, that's nice to say. I mean, that's how I feel about you. I think, you know, you've always been respected and admired by so many musicians, you know. You and Michael Brecker were the cats that, you know, Everybody listened to on a commercial tip. And then later when you started getting into jazz, it was just, so I've always admired you. And I've heard lots of stories about you, man. This is the way I heard. Check this out. I forgot this cat's name is from St. Louis. I forgot his name. He's a tenor player. He said that, you know, because Clark Terry was from St. Louis.
Yes.
And we were talking about Clark Terry. And then this cat said, well, you know, there was a club on the other side of the river. Apparently one side of the river was like where the white folks lived. And the other side was kind of like the best. Where the
black East St. Louis.
East St. Louis. Yeah. He said, I was at this club, man. And this, this teenager came, it was a black club, man. And all these cats were playing. He said, this kid came in, a teenager, man. And he said, I walked in there. The kid was turning the place out, man. He said, his name was David Sanborn.
Yeah, I got some of my early playing experience there with an organ group. You know, it was the Blue Note, 4200 Missouri Avenue, East St. Louis, right on an interstate. And we started at midnight and played from midnight until I think we did four sets. And it was, I got turned on to the place because there was a radio show. There was a famous DJ in St. Louis called Spider Burks. His name was Spider Burks. And he used to do a live radio broadcast every Saturday night from the Blue Note. This is Spider Burks. And while he was doing the show, when he was on the talking part, when he wasn't playing music, you could hear this, the pedal, you know, of a Hammond B3 organ.
Right.
And it was just like, it was like so cinematic, the sound. It was like, I remember listening to this show when I was a kid. And I say, someday I'm going to go there. You know, I think when I was about 16 or 17, a friend of mine named Philip Wilson, a drummer from St. Louis, he took me over there and we got a gig. I mean, he got me on this gig with Don James, organist, and Hammett Blewett was there, baritone saxophonist, and some other guys, Leo Littleman and Larry Prothrow and all these people. And I got, you know, somebody showed me a picture of me with that band in I don't even remember when it was, early 60s, you know, 65, 66. Maybe even earlier. No, much earlier than that, actually, early 61, 62. And it was like, you know, all these guys, you know, mature musicians. And there was this one white kid with a tie and a, you know, white shirt like this, you know, and I'm like, wow. And I said, I'm so grateful for the experience of playing with these seasoned mature musicians that, anyway, I digress into that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I so your legend started early, man. You learned from the cats. You know, I've always admired that about you. I mean, it's you know, the way the music is going now is just, it's going to,
yeah,
you know.
Well, it's interesting where it's going. You know, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of inner, you know, mixing of like hip hop and jazz.
Well,
You know,
all that's good. Yeah,
I think that's great. I mean, because it, you know, you have to respond to the times. You know, I think in a certain sense.
Yeah, but I'd like to hear a little more melody in some of this music. You know, I mean.
Yeah, me too.
But I mean, who am I to say? I mean, I just like to hear a little bit more melody. I mean, the stuff that you do, stuff Marcus Miller does, and that kind of stuff is really just stuff that's still among my favorite stuff. You know.
Yeah.
I like the guys with the sound. The cat from Texas. The tenor player, I can't remember his name. If I told you his name, you'd say it right. He used to play with Whitney Houston. He has several records.
Oh, Kirk Whalum.
Yeah, Kirk Whalum, you know. Have you ever recorded with him?
I don't think so, but we're good friends.
I would love to hear you two do a record
Yeah,
together.
Yeah, no, he's got that warm thing like the Gene Ammons had.
Yeah,
You know, that big fat, like Texas, Memphis, that kind of sound. Those big, that big fat sound. Woo, 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 woo. You know,
yeah. Well, I always wonder, you know, now that we're talking, I always wonder where your sound came from. I mean, it's more like you're like you know, Hank Crawford, maybe, or I don't know that many, you know.
He was my man. Hank
Yeah.
was my man. And I wanted to play tenor, but I was too small. So I kind of ended up with the alto. So I always thought like a tenor player because I was listening to.
What about Phil Woods? What about Phil?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Phil Woods, his percussive attack. And
Yeah.
He just like, he played like he just didn't give a f-.
Yeah.
The way he played, the way he's, you know, he would swing so hard. And that sense of swing, I think, is, and I realize that's kind of a marker for eras. That sense of swing, I sometimes search for that in the music of today. You know, I mean, I love backbeat and hip hop and all of that, but sometimes I just miss that swing.
Yeah, I think you have to grow up with it. I mean, unfortunately, you know, you're part of that generation that grew up playing, learned how to play in clubs, you know, and that just doesn't seem to exist that much anymore. There's a certain perfection that comes with music now that I don't enjoy, but you know, I'm glad the music is living. I'm glad that, you know, you're living. There's so many. I've had a question I wanted to ask you for a long time, and it has to do with a solo you did on, I think, it's not Anticipate. Oh, I had this in my mind. It was a solo you did on a.
You Belong to Me.
Yes.
Carly Simon. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
You know, it's so funny that you asked me that. I mean, like, there's so many musicians, they say, man, that solo that you played on that tune, it would really affected me. And I'm going, damn. And from the unlikeliest of places, Branford Marsalis said that to me. You know, he said that solo. It's like, wow. And I'm going, what? You know, because, you know, you do this stuff and you do it and forget about it, kind of.
Yeah,
You know,
but you play with such abandon. I just want to give the producer, whoever the producer was.
Arif Martin.
Oh, well, there it is. I mean, because
there it is.
Said in the control room, he said, if you hit that stop button, I'm going to kill you. He
yeah,
said,
right.
Just let him play.
Yeah.
Don't move. Don't move. Because it's a killing solo, man. It's one for the ages, really, in terms of that genre.
Yeah, well, he said, because he was this very elegant Turkish guy. And he goes, David, I just want you to, you know, you have to, your job is to connect this part of the song to the other part of the song. And just the way he described it, and the way, because he did the arrangements too. So he set this thing up, and I took a couple of passes at it. And he goes, that's beautiful, you know. And I go, what? Let me do it one more, you know. And then I heard it later, and I go, that's okay. I felt like I did my job. That was my job, to connect those two parts of the song.
Well, I mean, what you do as a jazz player, is what a good novelist does, which is you connect characters, you connect things. And so, I mean, a good studio player, there's a difference between like a good studio player and a really great musician who goes into the studio to try to create a story.
Yeah.
And that's what you've done effectively throughout your career. And that's something that I don't know if you're born with or whatever, but that's what the good ones do. And that's what happened in that song.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you know, that I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about the idea of storytelling. Because that was always what, you know, I didn't realize it. I didn't articulate it to myself at first, was that's what I was doing. But I wanted to tell a story, because all the guys that I listened to, especially Gene Ammons, he would play a solo and it would be like a story. It would have a narrative arc, have a beginning, you know, and a middle and an end. And, you know, I never thought of it as storytelling, but that's in effect what it was. You know, you kind of create a mood with the sound, and then you start the solo, you know, voop, voobadoo, boobadoo, boo, and then you develop a theme, and then you get to, you know, the middle part, and then you end it and you gracefully hand it off. And it's, you know, there it was. And that's what I loved about these guys, because they were conjuring this out of thin air, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that when you really get into music, you can figure out when someone's really got a story to tell. And the reason why I think cats like your music so much is because you're very generous. I mean, Gene Ammons is interesting because Ammons is, you know, he tells a complete little story. He just tells a complete little story. Whereas Sonny Rollins, if you listen to like St. Thomas, you know, he begins this phrase with bit off, and then he just works on this all, you know, bit off, and he ends up with that. And you say, well, this guy's got, like, it's not vocabulary we're hearing. We're hearing, and then we're reading a novel.
Yeah.
So Gene Ammons is, his style, I mean, his story is different. He's a different writer. He's Alex Haley as opposed to being, you know, James Baldwin or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Good soloists really have a story to tell. And that, I think, is what's missing. Now, look, these young guys can play, but until they get older, they're not as, like Bramford had a story. As soon as he arrived, he had a story.
That's right.
He just had a story. He had a, you know, he was a storyteller. You know, and you wanted to listen to stories that he had to tell. But I think the difference between music and writing books is that, first of all, you have to follow a tableau. You know, if you're playing in B flat, you know, you're playing F sharp, you better think of it as a G flat, or you better have some reason to do it, or be Charlie Parker, or it should be a passing tone or something. But there is a framework.
Yeah.
Novels have to make the same kind of demands, except that you can hand it, you have to be careful who you hand it off to. You have to be careful who you hand the story off to. So in my stories, I'm always a little bit afraid that someone's going to just grab it and run out the room. That has happened in the past. And either it's not as good a novel, or I'm not good enough to contain the solo for the 12 or 16 bars, or I'm not good enough, like Arif Martin was good enough to say, look, just get out the way. This cat is feeling it.
Yeah.
He don't even know he's feeling it. Just put it, and then I'm gonna make some money from it, and that's the end of that.
Yeah.
So, but it's a different. What I find, though, is that musicians, good musicians, are innately really good storytellers. I mean, verbally, as well as you know, musically. Not all the time, but often. And I've tried to channel that and harness that in my work. The difference is, though, you have to do so much research when you write a novel that you don't have to do that when you, well, your research is in your practice when you play.
Yeah.
And it's solitary. You don't have to depend on the organist to show up, and, you know, or the bass player not to be drunk, or the club owner to, you know, or the record date to go. You don't have to worry about that.
You don't have that spontaneous interaction.
No, and also, no, you don't. But and oftentimes when you go back to look at it, you have to be careful, you know, because you start rewriting the life out of your work. And you have to, you know, you do have to cut, strengthen, and all that, but you have to be careful that it's not, that it still has buoyancy, you know.
Just interject that I think an important part of being a player, an improviser, is the ability to listen and realize that you don't, it's not up to you to carry this whole story forward. It's like when you're on stage, I always liken it to just you're having a conversation on stage within the framework of the song. And you
Right.
know, because you're like saying, I don't think this, and then the drummer goes, oh yeah. And then the piano player reacts to that. So you're having a five-way conversation in real time. And that's the surprising part of it. But an essential part of that is listening, because the hardest thing to learn, I think, for a lot of young musicians is to leave space. Because it's like you got to use that space. You know, like the master of that is Miles. You know, full, and then, you know, some time. And then, you know, when do you come back in? When
Right.
do you know, when do you say something? When do you come back in? And, you know, you get good enough players around you, they're going to react in a certain way. Herbie's going to go this way, and Tony Williams is going to go that way. And then Miles is going, okay. You know, so it's like, in a way, it's, you don't have to do all the heavy lifting. It's like going into, you know, you wander the halls of the Berklee School of Music and you hear 20 tenor players playing the shit out of Giant Steps.
Right.
But that's not their story.
Right.
You know, and
Well,
they're doing it in a vacuum. You know, they
right.
get out there and they play Giant Steps and they're done.
Right.
You
Right.
know.
Right. Well, I mean that's the good, well, listen, I always tell young musicians that music, it's not a great way to make a living. It's a great way to live. And so, but it's not a great way to live if you just learn how to play Giant Steps and you can play all the notes in the world. I mean, the problem is though, that these cats have grown up, these men and women have grown up listening to people like you, and you know, and Train and all these other cats, you know, who make it seem easy, and who when they tell their note, when they tell their story, they're thinking in terms of notes, and not in terms of story. And so, I hear 1,000 cats now who try to sound like David Sanborn, 1,000 cats who try to sound like Dexter or whoever, and. I mean, the problem is that the life experience that they need to live, they're not living. And without that life experience, how do you make music that's worthy? I mean, I think the best thing to do is to learn to help somebody. I wish I could make every musician in the world become a tutor in a kindergarten class or work in a homeless shelter for a year or two. It would make your music so much better. You know, it's hard to make people do that, you know.
Well, there's a quote from your college professor at Oberlin, who I went to school with, by the way, Wendell Logan.
No kidding.
Yes, I went to the University of Iowa there. He was a doctoral candidate
Oh,
in
man.
Iowa, and I was a I think I was a junior. I don't remember because I never accumulated enough credits to even be a sophomore. So I just was there to hang out. I was at Northwestern for a while. Anyway, but Wendell, who I met, you know, my first year there, he I think it was in the foreword to one of your books. You quoted him saying, if you're not about the truth, you're not qualified to play any type of music.
Let me tell you something. Wendell, my best friend is named Leander Bean. He's a classical pianist. He lives in D.C. And we were taking a Wendell's arranging course. And so we had the midterm. You had to do like a, you know, like a four part, you know, you had to do arrangement with a rhythm section and like, you know, four horns. And so when he handed the arrangements back, I got a C on mine, and Leander, who was a classical cat, got an A. And so I waited till the class room emptied. And then I said to Wendell, I said, you know, I said, listen, Wendell, you know, Leander Now, this is so kind of jive cat I was. I said, Leander got an A, and I got a C, and I just implied that, basically I said, I kind of did like this with my hands, so like I'm Black Wendell and you're Black Wendell, and Leander's an A, and I said you gave him an A and I got a C, and Wendell he looked at me like, and he said to me, I gave Leander an A because he deserved it. And he said, I gave you a C, which just became a D. He said, don't you ever come in here and talk to me like that again. He said, this music is about the truth. And if you are not about the truth, you're not qualified to play it. And that was the greatest lesson I got from Oberlin
Yes.
Conservatory.
Yeah.
Because it was, and Leander, by the way, is still my best friend. And that was just being a creep. But it's funny because that, there's that dynamic too. I just had a conversation last week with Michael Mossman, the arranger, who
Yes.
I went to school. Mike and I played in the same group together. We were a quartet, and Mike wanted to join. And it was four black cats in the group, and they were all good players. They all became very well known. I don't want to name them because I'm about what I'm going to say. But anyway, Mike remembered this story. I didn't. But Mike said when he wanted to join the group, they didn't want him to join because he was white. And this is what Mike told me that I said. He said, you said, look, this cat can play. I want him to join. And so he did join. And he was more advanced than any of us in the group. And we all became very close. We knew each other. Mike is getting married soon. I might go to the wedding next Friday. It's third time around. I mean, I said, Mike, I need to
Hey,
get that. But
takes time to get it right. Right.
he's a great arranger, man. He's just and a great trumpet player. But
Right.
anyway, the music tells the truth all the time.
Yeah,
It
but that's an important lesson to learn, because if you focus on telling the truth, then everything else starts to fall into place. But you also, implicit in that, you got to figure out what the truth is, and that's where you got to dig deep, I think, in my opinion. What is the truth?
Well, I mean, the truth is, at least in a general way, that as storytellers, both you and I have a lot in common because we've witnessed a lot of things that we can't do much about. We witnessed a lot of injustice that we do the little that we can, and the rest is we kind of have to be bent on our own survival and our own success. And so we see a lot of people who fall by the wayside who should not have fallen by the wayside. And we just have to leave it to God because there's nothing we can do to alleviate their situation. I mean, and in my case, I know a lot of really very fine writers and musicians who for whatever reason just didn't figure out a way to get through. And then I find myself a little bit isolated. I remember hearing George Benson say there was someone was saying on the radio he was being interviewed, and they said, well, George, you went from jazz to pop, and a lot of jazz cats don't like pop music, and George Benson said, well, you lose a lot of old friends, but then you make a lot of new ones too, so it kind of evens out. And so we live in that tight space, you and I,
When you get ostracized because
right.
you went a certain way, and people make an assumption that you did that for reasons other than honest reasons. Well, you did that like, you sold out. I mean, that was like, I remember they said, you say that way, say that about Freddie Hubbard. Like, oh, he's sold out. He's making those records at CTI. But then, he made great records. And this cat, whatever he played was by definition, it was jazz. I mean, he
Absolutely.
could, on his worst day, he could smoke 90% of the other musicians anywhere. He could just, and he could act, as far as I was concerned, he could act however he wanted to act. Because if you make music like that, that's the hand of God touched you. And the joy beyond the way he lived, that was irrelevant to me. What was meaningful was just that he commanded the moment. I saw him with Art Blakey, with a classic band. It was him and Wayne Shorter, Curtis Fuller, Jimmy Merritt, and Bobby Timmons. And I saw him, and he walked in the club. He had like a swagger that was, you know, there were three women at the front table that were obviously with him. And he just, you know, walked on, and he played this solo that just ripped the place apart. And then he just like, you know, and then he profiled and, you know, and whatever, you know. It's like these people are, I don't know what the right word to describe these people are. They're messengers from beyond. They tell the story.
Well, that's the problem, though. That's the problem. You hit the nail right on the head. You know, we're never going to be like the, I think our concern is that, you know, those who come behind us don't get, I just thought we're at a different radio station. We're on the end of the dial, you know. Yeah. We're like WBGO. We're on the very end, and you know, you're hoping some, and you're hoping that this. See, when cats like Freddie and yourself, you know, that generation of cats were out here playing. There was no road. You just kept going. There was nobody. Yeah. Nobody was cutting trail. I mean, Train and Sonny and these cats, you know, and Nina Simone, they cut little trails, and you went in there with your little sword and you cut it a little wider and hoped that a lion or tiger wouldn't jump out and have you for lunch.
Yeah.
But now there's a whole road, there's a whole highway. And these people come in and they're like, they're going down the highway and they're doing, are we going to have a, you know, like some Bill and I were talking and he said they're having some kind of all women's jazz band, and you know, it's and I know what he was saying. What he was saying was that he's all for all women's jazz band, but the people who are dead, who cut trail for this, they get no benefit from that. Nothing. Yeah. All those guys you play with, Wild Bill Doggett, all these guys, you play with some bad dudes, man. Nobody knows who they are.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And you know, you're one of them. I mean, you're walking history. I used to feel that way about my mother, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I used to see my mother walking down the street, and I'd be walking next to her and I'd say, you know what? She's history. She's walking history. She doesn't even know it. And what do you say to someone like that? You know, best thing you do is thank them, you know, like, thank you, man. You know, thank you for what you've done. It's kind of like that. But anyway,
listen to their story, you know, and just listen to their story. And like you did and like you do, you tell their story also through the lens of your own experience and in the context of today. And I mean, I love in The Color of Water, the way you jumped back and forth like that. It was like you informed, you know, it was head spinning. But it was also, it was emotionally exhausting, but it was incredible. I felt like I had been somewhere.
Well, I grew up listening to 45 RPMs.
You know, me too. Little Richard.
That's right. So Sly and the Family Stone, you know, and all that business. And buying a record for 72 cents or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And actually buying a record and sitting down and listening to it. But I always wanted to ask you, I have so many, I always wanted to ask you questions. Like, did you ever work with Steely Dan?
I did one session with them, you know, one time. And I played on an album called Gaucho. And I just I just played in the section. You know, I never really, you know, but I was witness to their work ethic and their style of like, they were, everything was like a deliberation, every note, every solo, like, you know, like, like, and it was, you know, it felt like the antithesis of spontaneous creation. But then they made these great, beautiful structures, you know.
Well, that's a different kind of storytelling. That's more like poetry. You know, poets sit there and they just, you know, they just, you know, they just deliberate about a single word for, for hours or even days. And they're like more like the poets of music, whereas people like, I don't know, Train and Miles and so many others were more like, Joe Zawinul. They were more not novelists. They had an idea and they would splurt, they would just flow it out. And I mean, Sonny was a true novelist, and Joe Lovano is a novelist,
Yes, absolutely. Joe Lovano is a true master of
Yeah,
the
he's great.
craft because there's joy, there's intensity, there's variety. There, you hear the whole history of the tenor saxophone in his playing. You know, he goes everywhere and effortlessly. He slides in and out of being inside and outside, like Joe Henderson was like that. You know, he could play out and then he could play, the hardest groove and swing, because he played with Horace Silver for a long time on, Song for My Father and all these great, more inside the lines kind of thing. And then he played out too. He did an album with Larry Young called Unity. That's one of the, to me, one of the greatest jazz albums ever. It was Elvin Jones, Larry Young, and Woody Shaw, and Joe Henderson, and he played some iconic solos on that record. And it's just like, but he would go in and out of, like, you know what I mean by out, just like, and then come back in, like he'd never, like he was a, he knew where he was, but he knew how to get back in without missing a beat. And
Yeah, with
that's
Joe Lovano, Joe Henderson could do, well, actually, you do that as well. I
well.
mean, the really good players can do it, and they do it seemingly effortlessly, but they're not doing it to show, hey, I guess what I can do.
No.
It's just, that's a dry hump, for a better word. I mean, it's just, it's no good. It just doesn't,
Yeah, dry hump. Yeah.
It just doesn't work. I mean, now but there are others who I mean, I have a hard time with the, it's really about the struggle. And I think that, the older musicians have had to struggle, and that struggle has shown them how, in some way, how to play. Because playing music is not hard. Playing it well is hard. And that's really, and that a lot of that has to do with struggle. And that's kind of like why I do books, man, because, well, I'm 66 now, man, and I don't want to go on the road anyway. But it's just a lot, it's a lot easier and to sit at home and write books. I mean, it's lonely though, because like where I live in a little town in central New Jersey. There's not a lot of musicians around here, so there's nobody really to play with. Not that I'm, not that Joe Henderson would be sitting up in his grave, like waiting for me to pull my horn out, But it would be nice if there was some more players around here. But anyway, keeping the music alive and keeping it alive. I've tried to write about music. I did one time. I wrote about James Brown. I'll never do that again. That resulted in a lawsuit that was quite costly.
And I guess painful too, because what I mean, what you talked about in that book was just like the pain and the overlooked genius and the quality that James Brown had and the depth his music had and the depth he had as a human being
Well,
to
not only that, but the musicians. I
Oh.
mean, the guys who play. I mean, some of these guys, I know you and Maceo did a record together or did
Yeah.
some cuts
It's
together.
some, yeah.
And
Pee Wee Ellis.
Pee Wee Ellis. I knew Pee Wee Ellis very well. In fact, I was at his memorial in Harlem, and Pee Wee was with Fred Wesley too. But Pee Wee
Oh.
wrote, he co-wrote Cold Sweat, and
Cold Sweat, which
yeah.
was So What
Right, that's right.
with a
Oh
funk
man,
beat.
this is great. Yeah, that's right. It was So
You know,
What?
it was, first time I heard Cold Sweat on the radio, I had to stop my car. I had to pull over because I said, something just shifted in the universe. This is some whole new shit. And I don't know, man, but whatever it is, I'm there. And it changed the dynamic for everybody, for all of us, because without him, no Sly. Without him, no George Clinton. Without him,
How
no.
old were you when you heard Cold Sweat? How old were you? A
I
teenager? Were
don't
you a
know.
young man?
I was a teenager. I'm trying to remember when it was, but
Must have been 65 or maybe early 60s, early 60s.
yeah, it was the early 60s. So I was probably still in school. And I think I was back on summer break and I was playing at the Blue Note on
The
4200
one in
Missouri
St. Louis.
Avenue, the
Yeah,
one in
okay.
St. Louis. Yeah. And I said, the world just changed, and it was
Wow.
like, it was that, to me, it was that profound. And, and then everything that followed from that, all the other records. And then I had the good fortune at one point to actually play with him a very brief period of time, because his arranger was a guy named Dave Matthews, who I
Oh,
met
I
one of the
heard of
first
him.
people. Yeah, one of the first people I met when I came to New York. And James was doing an album called Hell. And I was, so I went in the studio and he was in there. I mean, it was very, I can't say I really knew him. And then I played with him. I subbed for somebody because by then Maceo, I think, had left. And I don't know if he had, it was one of his interim periods, but I played with him at the Apollo
No kidding.
just one night. And it was like, this is like,
Did he give
okay.
you some love? Did you solo and all that?
Yeah, I mean, he did it. He acknowledged me, not verbally, but
Right.
I don't even remember what the tune that I played a solo on. It didn't matter because I was there with this hit. It was like Moses.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I hear
It was
you.
just like these experiences of being, because when you play with these people, it's like a master class. In you don't even realize what because like it was Sonny Rollins, it was the same thing. I'd listened to Sonny from the time I was a kid, and then when I finally had a chance to play with him, it's like, oh shit, this is a nuclear reactor, and stuff's flying at you so fast and furious because he's doing this in real time. The way he works the time and the humor. That's the thing that always struck me about Sonny was his sense of humor. And it was just, I mean,
Yeah, he's profound. He's a profound case. Profound. I have a whole bunch of sayings from here that I've heard Sonny say, and I used to talk to him all the time. I just found it. I had it. It's on my desk somewhere. I just had it, and I don't know what happened to it. But he used to say some profound. He told me one time that he was in a club with Lester Young. He was, and or he. I don't know if he heard this or he saw this, but he said Lester Young was in a club. And these cats, everyone was playing and they sounded great. And after they played, they'd go up to Les Young and they'd say, "What did you think?" And Les Young, Les Young would say, "That's good. Now what's your story?" And that had an effect on me, hearing that. But James's his band, Brown's band, it wasn't just the horn players that really
No.
not got a lot of, like the rhythm player, the guitar player.
Jabbo Starks, the drummer.
Jabbo Starks, the
Yeah.
drummer,
Yeah.
Country, the guy named Country used to play the rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
I think the guitarists don't get a lot of
I
credit
know,
for what they've done in
especially
music.
him, because he played one thing, but it was absolutely essential for the rest, everything else to work. It was like this Swiss watch, but all those parts are like moving, and it's just like, it becomes more than the sum of its parts.
Do you think anyone could ever get a band to sound that tight now?
I don't know. It's a combination of commitment and fear, I think, because
Interesting.
I think James really, I mean, because he was so 100% committed to it that I don't think he, broached any kind of anything less than full commitment. And I don't think he always handled it in the most artful way, but he was determined to get this thing, and whatever his motives were, it didn't matter. I mean, I it's like it's like the rest of his life, the caricature of his life, especially toward the end. I mean, it was just so
Oh, man.
pointless and brutal talking about talking about him like that. I was so disrespectful, and it broke my heart to see that, because that's not who he was.
Yeah, you know? I mean, he was a good person. I mean, he's like all of us, you know, we try to do, we, you know, look, it's not like we're Wall Street brokers and, you know, trying to take people's money. Not that they all do that, but you know what I mean? It's not like we're grifters or anything like that, but we're trying to just do good in the world. And what happens is the punishment of it is so great that it turns people into things that they normally shouldn't be. He was quite complicated, not complicated cat. And the thing about being a musician and what his musicians witnessed, and I'm sure what you witnessed over the course of your career as well, is that there are a lot of complicated things that you see that you simply don't say anything about. It just comes out of the horn or your guitar or your drums. Yeah. You don't.
Well, you're trying to, I mean, for me, and I mean, I would imagine it would be the same for you, because I've heard you talk either directly about this or around this, that I know I'm just trying to figure out my life when right. I play, whether I write a song or whether I'm just playing, I'm trying to figure it out. And when you're on that quest, in the first place, it never ends,
right?
You know, right. And that's the beautiful part of it, because, and you have a record called The Process,
right? Right.
Because that's it in a nutshell, because that encompasses commitment, journey, commitment to the moment, and humility, because you realize you're never going to get there. I remember Wayne Shorter once said, you know, he said, sometimes it's better to reach for a note and miss it than it is to reach for a note and get it, because it's like the effort, the reach, and that's the drama of life. And I mean, you know, it's, you know, I'm trying this and this, I kind of didn't make it here, but you know, I'm going to keep going. And life, as we all know, moves on, and you just keep trying, and you keep, but we're human, we're frail, we're, you know, we have that frailty, but we have that commitment and the humility and the love to just go on. Cause I don't want to, you know, I'm never going to figure out my life, but I'm going to keep trying.
Well, know? I mean, the beauty is for the listener who hears this, who hears your search, is that you've managed, or those of us who managed to make a living at it, or are lucky enough to make a living at it, is that it's compelling enough for people to be entertained by. I just saw months ago, Bruce Hornsby was in the area. I went to see him. He's a good friend of mine. And here's a guy who's always reaching for something. He's always reaching for something. And his band, they're all reaching for something. They're all reaching for the same thing. And you can feel the humility in the reaching. Yeah. And I think that's what you're talking about. And I agree with that. It can't be that I know what the answer is. It has to be, I'm trying to find it. The search, look, the journey, it's never about the story. It's about the journey.
Yeah.
The story is just incidental. There are 1,000 novels written, 250 books come out every week or whatever. It's the journey that you try to keep. And same thing with records. I mean, you know, this, it's the journey for, and I can remember, I mean, I can remember so many of records, and everything is always, there's always a searching, you know, that's involved with the records that you've done, and the recording that you've done. I mean, you know, when I listen to you and Maceo play together, it was just so enjoyable, because you're so different. You're both such rhythmic players. You play so hard, and you play so direct, but it's completely different.
In a different way.
Yeah, in a different way. It just was killing, man. Killing.
Yeah, well, you know, I just want a personal plug. I just did a new record that actually Jonathan Duckett, my engineer, who is also your engineer,
right,
is in the process of mixing, and I really want to send it to you, because it's in more of a, I hate to use this word, but more of a straight ahead kind of context, not like, you know, ding, ting, ting, but it's like it's got more of that conversational aspect in a different context. A lot of, you know, high energy. Anyway, I don't want to.
Well, I think your listeners would be happy to accept. I mean, the work you do with Joey DeFrancesco, I was thinking of it when he died, was just killing, man. And I can't imagine that. I'm sure that I was wondering. I wanted to ask you this. You know, as you've gotten older, you know, you've seen the just kind of float further and further away from just straight up, you know, just funk, you know, funk to something that's freer. And you know, you've always played with this sense of like urgency, like something's just bursting to get out. I think that's part of it. I mean, in addition to have just a wonderful sound, which, you know, we should talk about that too, but just this urgency just to get out something that's just dying to spread. But as you've gotten older, it seems you've gone more into the, you know, kind of a swing or more freer. And it's just wonderful to hear, man, because your vocabulary is actually quite impressive, man, immense. And you don't get a chance to hear that in constraints.
Yeah, in a funk context, because I think that limits you in a way. You know, and I mean, I think for me, it was just circumstances that led me to going the way I went in my life. You know, it was just, you know, because I grew up playing organ trio music, you know, and hearing things in that, you know, because one of the first songs I remember hearing that really turned me on was a song called Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett. Ba da ba bi da ba bi da bong, ba da bi da ba bi da bong. And I heard that solo. I think it was, I don't remember who the tenor, but Clifford Jarvis, I think, was a tenor player. And he was playing, and he played this solo that was like, da 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 da. And I'm saying, that's like, what the hell is he doing? And I sat there for hours and hours and transcribed, because I didn't read music and nobody was transcribing that stuff. And then I just, later on, I figured out, okay, it's the 12-8 that they're feeling over the four. The time's going like this, don't, but they're going, bop it deep, boop it deep, bop it deep, bop it deep, bop. And that's where the swing was for me. Ba ba do, bop, bop. So you interrupt that, you know, you don't play every note, da 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 dee da 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 da. So you construct these solos, but using that, always feeling that 12-8 as well as a straight four in your mind. And that was just, that became automatic for me. And that led me to Hank Crawford and all these other cats like Fathead Newman, you know, guys that were more, I would say, earthy, where there was more obvious church happening in their music, more of the gospel thing.
That makes it makes a complete sense now. It allows me to listen to you a little more differently now, because that's how you play. You play as if, you know, and it surprises the listener. That's the difference between you and Maceo, really.
Yeah,
I mean, both of you have enormous groove. I mean, if you just cut the drums out and just listen, you would hear. But you seem to just come out a different. Just out of nowhere, and you know, you're trying to, how does this cat come up with that? I see that now.
Well, I mean, James Brown used to tell everybody in his band, you know, you're all are drummers. Everybody in this band is a drummer. So it was like me playing with Maceo, it was like two drummers playing together. Okay, so it's like two different kind of, we're both feeling the momentum, the flow, but it's, you know, hearing different ways of looking at it. It's like, I know I'm sure you've had this experience playing with different drummers. Some drummers feel the time on the backside of the time. Some drummers play way on top.
Right.
And, you know, and you're going to play different depending on how a drummer plays, you know.
Well, I would imagine it'd be hard for a young drummer, I mean, a drummer to play with you now because they have to have so many tools. They have to have the pocket thing too tight. And then they have to be, you know, they have to know when to, you know, lay off the one, maybe because you got something coming. I wouldn't want to be the drummer in your band, man. That'd be, that'd be, That'd be too hard, probably.
I mean, sometimes you play with some drummers, they will never give you the one. Like Jack DeJohnette. Like, you can wait a week. It's like waiting for a bus that never comes. You won't, you're not going to get a one. And Alvin was a little bit like that. And Roy Haynes was a little like that. You know?
Well, I heard a story about Roy Haynes when I was in Africa once. I was over there doing a story for the National Geographic about music. And there was an African musician told me that Roy Haynes came to Senegal and he was playing with the great Senegalese master drummers. They had to put together a bunch of drummers and they were playing together and they had a kit set up for Roy Haynes to play. And he said, three times Roy Haynes tried to enter and he couldn't get in. He said the third time Haynes, he took his sticks and he threw them in the air and he laughed. And then the master drummer, he put everything, he backed them all down until you could hear the one. And he said, then Roy Haynes got his sticks and he started playing. And then he took them back up to where they were. And he said, it was like he went wild. He said he was like a free man. He was flying like a bird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's trying to figuring how to get in. What's my point of entry? And what's the orientation here?
I can't believe you're using those words. Those are the words I use when I write books and I talk to writers.
Yeah. How do you get in? You know, and it's like sometimes it just takes a while to say, okay, what's the core of what I'm writing? And sometimes you'll abandon that core in the process of writing a song. I mean, Marcus and I were working on an album called Up Front, and we were writing a tune called Snakes. But the way we got there, we were listening to there was a James Brown collection that came out, Star Time, that was a collection of all of his recordings, like, you know, everything from the beginning, you know, Prisoner of Love and all that stuff, going way back. And then we were figuring out, okay, we're going to write a James Brown record. And then so Marcus ended up writing this tune called Snakes that has got no clear connection to James Brown. But in a way, it does, because that's where it came from. It was just like, this is how I look at it. It's like, you know, writing a book about a journey, and it's like, all, you know, okay, all of a sudden you're writing the Odyssey. You know, you're in this epic poem by Homer, or you're... You know, I just wrote, you know, David Copperfield or Huckleberry Finn. It's just like, you know, Jesus, you know, when in fact, you know, nobody can bust you because there's no clear, you covered your tracks or you forgot about it.
Well, that's what happens. It becomes your voice. It becomes your voice. That's why that's really, you know, that's what younger players and younger writers don't. Mm-hmm. Understand. It's like when you try to ape somebody, I tell young writers, try to ape somebody as much as you can. Yeah. And then after you finish aping them, throw that out and then write your story. Because, you know, you and Marcus can sit down with a James Brown record and say, okay, let's see if we can. And then you'll go down an alley and you'll know really quickly whether that alley is working or not. And
you'll say,
well, you know what, this is, and then until something comes out that, you know, that works for both of you. I mean, I think you and Marcus are a wonderful team, by the way. I mean, when y'all get together to work, man.
What I owe him is beyond measuring. You know, I mean, he helped, you know, not only personally, but he helped me keep my shit together when I was going through a difficult period. You know, I went a little off the rails. Well, that's an understatement. You know, when I couldn't, you know, and Marcus pulled me back in, and he was very patient, and he helped focus me and bring me back.
Well, and Marcus is the son of a preacher. He's the son of a preacher.
Yeah, you know, a deacon, I think.
Yeah, that's even higher, man. That's even higher, man.
Yeah, so he's got that. And, you know, his uncle was Wynton Kelly.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, he said, Marcus, he's told me that, he said, because Wynton was supposed to be playing in the church every Sunday. And a lot of times he would, you know, Wynton would be off on a gig and then would, you know, whatever, oversleep,
Right,
fall
right,
asleep,
right,
and
right.
not Megan. So Marcus's father would have to play piano to in the church. Yeah, I thought
I
that
didn't
was
know
really.
that. Wow, man. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I saw him a couple of years ago. I was trying to convince him to move back east, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen.
But I just heard of his the guitar player that was in that bus crash of his, Louis Cato, I think
Yeah,
his name.
who's now the band director on Stephen Colbert.
Yeah. Well, this cat has a record that's wonderful, man. He's really
Oh,
good.
he was a drummer at that when Mark when he was playing with Marcus.
No kidding.
Yeah, he was a drummer. But he also played organ, and I mean, he was one of those wunderkind
And them
kind of
scary cats.
guys.
Yeah,
Yeah,
wow.
scary
I didn't
cat.
know that, man.
Yeah, and he was very young, I think, when he was with Mark. He got hurt pretty bad
Yeah,
in a
that was
crash.
apparently a
It wasn't
bad.
good.
It was a bad. It was a bad. It was a bad situation. I'm glad
Yeah.
he recovered. He's got a wonderful record. He's got his own sound. He's one of these young guys
Yeah.
who makes you feel good about,
Yeah,
you know,
the
music.
future.
The music will survive. Don't you? I mean, I get worried sometimes about what's going to happen in music, only because I hear so many people who sound so much the same. And in all fairness, they won't get the kind of training, you know. I mean, I guess it's just a different world, you know.
Not the same kind. You know, I mean, you there's not the opportunity to go out there and play clubs and get your ass kicked.
Right.
Because I think the ass kicking is part of the process, because when you're up there on stage and you get humiliated in public, that's a lesson you won't forget, you know. But now there's the because of circumstances, like you say, it's mostly contained to like, you know, academia. You know, so
Right.
you're in a class, a jazz class, where you learn to improvise, and you can fail, and you can do it kind of in a relatively secure environment. And I think I don't know if that encourages risk taking or discourages it. I'm not sure, but it's how you interface, because sooner or later you're going to have to go out there and learn. And I think the thing I worry about young cats in jazz programs, and they're going to be, you know, majoring in jazz, they're actually just going to be end up teaching. You
Well,
know,
that
because
happens. Yeah, that happens. So, well, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean,
no, nothing.
but the problem really is that we don't develop audiences in this country very well. And we don't
No.
support the music very well, and we don't even support the musicians very well. A student, I mean, a person like Marcus and you and others in your generation, Branford, you shouldn't even have to tour. You should be. You know, you should look. We have philharmonic orchestras in every city, and the musicians in those orchestras who are deserving make decent living, and they should probably make more. But you know, there's no almost no support for professional level jazz players, especially the few masters that are left among us. There's no reason why Marcus at his age should have to tour. But we do what we have to do.
Well, I think Marcus tours at this point because he wants to. Because he spent years not touring, because he didn't really tour. I mean, he decided to start a family, and he's very family oriented. He wanted to be with his family. And first, for a while, he was in West Orange, and then he moved out to LA because he could, you know, he could get some film work and some TV work. And he didn't want to tour because he wanted to be there to raise his kids. So he
Right.
spent 20 years not touring. And so
Right.
when the kids all graduated and got free, he was like, okay,
Right.
now I can go on the road. And he went on the road with a vengeance. I mean, he was
Well,
like,
I guess he, you know, I suppose he does. I mean, whatever he's doing, I love what he's doing. I mean, I love
yeah.
it. You know, I mean, and if he wants to tour, then more power to him. But I would
Yeah.
like to see. I mean,
Not
I can't
have to
think of him
tour.
off the top of my head. I just like to see. I just think there's a higher level, like Mike Mossman was telling me that he does these arrangements for the German radio bands and so forth.
WDR, yeah.
Yeah, I mean they're supported by the government, and
Yeah.
you know we have a government that, you know, don't get me started, but I mean
Yeah.
the whole business of grant writing and the whole business of being recognized as a MacArthur Fellow. So every year, one person gets a MacArthur Fellowship,
yeah,
deserves it. But there are so many others who are deserving who have really put in their time. I mean,
yes.
And if I were a government official, I'd say there must be, I don't know, maybe 30 to 50 people in this country who have just put in their time. Like
yeah.
Jerry Dodson. I don't even know if Jerry Dodson's still living, but Jerry Dodson was one, an alto
Yeah.
player.
Sure, I know Jerry.
I mean, just a great player, you know, played with for Sinatra for years. These guys created the sound that is going around
Yeah.
the world.
Yeah, I mean, Kenny Garrett,
Kenny
he's still
Garrett.
out there. He's still, you know, still pretty active. I mean, he's a relatively young man. I mean, you think he's, I mean, from now, all of a sudden, I went from being the youngest guy in the room to being the oldest guy in the room.
Yeah.
I'm like 78, and I'm talking to guys in their late six, like you, and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, how did that happen? You know?
Well, I mean, it just goes to show you, because when we were coming out of school, you know, when I came out of school in 79.
Yeah.
You were like, you in terms of studio recording, you and Michael Brecker were the two cats who were doing a lot of that work, which we all wanted to do. And few of us did it because there was so little of it to do anyway. And then as the years passed, you evolved into, you know, straight out, because that whole business of that, the whole business of what has now become Easy Listening. I can think of two cats, yourself and Grover Washington Jr.,
yeah,
who really pushed it, who created the genre. And
yeah, for better or for worse, you know.
Did you ever meet Grover, by the way?
Sure, I knew Grover. We never played together, but I knew Grover.
I worked with Grover. I wrote a couple of songs with Grover.
Yeah,
I actually played electric piano on a song Grover was playing tenor on, and later Ramsey Lewis came and played piano, but it wasn't a very good song. But I mean, still, you know. He was great. I asked Grover, I said to him, man, you're funky, man. I said, how come you didn't play with James Brown? He said, man, I'm not funky enough. He said, David Sanborn and Maceo, they're funky enough. He said, I ain't funky. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I mean, you know, you think of me as one of the aspects of me is like as a studio musician. I was never a studio musician because, first of all, I couldn't double. I didn't play clarinet. I didn't play flute. I didn't do any of that stuff. So the only time I really worked was with Mike and Randy Brecker, because we would get called in as a section. And then occasionally I would get called to play a solo on something. But I would do if I was lucky, I would do one. In my busiest year, I would do maybe one session a month.
Isn't
but a lot of what I did had high profile. So people thought I was everywhere, because I did solos, but I couldn't really read, and I wasn't that dexterous with my playing. Because this is funny too, because when I, you know, I was, you know, in the Good Lord Bird, not the Good Lord Bird, Color of Water. I read about your grandmother, you know, who had polio, and I had polio. So my left hand is fucked up. So I had to figure out ways around, because all that dexterity in the left hand, I couldn't do. So I figured out ways to bullshit my way through that. So people thought I had all this technique. I didn't have any of that, because I couldn't just like, oh, okay, you know. So I can only raise my left arm high enough just barely to reach the left hand. So I'm hanging on up there. I'm not, you know, playing on the top of it. You know, I'm holding the horn a certain way because that's the only way I can get anything out.
No kidding.
That's why I never could never play clarinet, because of the dexterity that was involved.
That's amazing. So,
yeah, and that just led me. I was never a very good reader.
Yeah, but see, you know what it is? Your sound and your approach to, because you never played a lot of shit. You played just seemed like the right shit. And you know, we were talking earlier about your rhythmic approach. It, you know, it, because what the listener gets, you talked about point of view, is that somebody just comes out of nowhere and they do some shit that just like How did you? I mean, I'm sure Marcus could because he's played with you. He could describe it better than I can. Bruce Hornsby has a violin player who does that. Like this cat just comes out of nowhere. I'm just like, where did it? You know. And so, while you might not have thought of yourself as a studio player, that's where most of us heard you.
I know, I
Because we
understand.
didn't hear, we didn't know Paul Butterfield and them cats. We didn't, you know, but we heard you there. And then we went and got your records when you did shit with Bob James and all that kind of stuff. That's interesting though, but it was all about the sound. All about the sound and the approach. And then of course, Michael Brecker, he was a cat who had great chops, man.
He was a demon. I've never heard anybody that played the saxophone as well as he did. I mean, in terms of raw technique, there was nobody better. His ability to control, he was a great drummer too, and a great piano player. So he could play with the time, like the way Sonny could play with the time. You know, Michael was a different player, of course, but he could like go in and out of all these counter rhythms. Like when we were playing together with the Brecker brothers, we'd be on the road and we'd play these tunes like some Skunk Funk or whatever it was, and there'd be tunes where both Michael and I would play solos, and I would always make a point of going first because nobody wants to follow Mike Brecker. And one time I made the mistake, I was, you know, f***ing with my reed or something before, and the solo time hit and Michael went up and he just napalmed the stage. And, you know, it was like stunning and just being intimidated because like he left nothing for me. Like, I find one eighth note over in the corner, like, hey, I can, you know, and I played doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-
Thad Jones, Mel Lewis's big band? Sure. You ever play with them?
No, I never did.
That's one of
the disappointments. I knew Mel. I never met Thad. You know.
Wow.
I knew Hank and I knew Elvin, but I never knew Thad.
Wow.
I know a beautiful song of his, "A Child Is Born."
Oh yeah, yeah.
I know
yeah.
that song.
Roland Hannah. Sir Roland Hannah wrote that.
Oh, well, I thought Thad wrote that.
No. Wendell told me, because Wendell knew Sir Roland Hannah. He came to Oberlin one time and he said he wrote it, but Thad took it. I mean, I don't know who knows, but Thad was a great arranger. Great arranger. Great band.
You know, I listened to that it was a Jonathan Duckett sent me a video of you playing with the young students at the New Brown Memorial Church. That did one of your songs, "I Hear a Song."
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
What a beautiful song that is, man.
Oh really, man, well, you know, man. No, but I mean, the truth is I've never really done a record. I mean, I'm more of a composer than I'm a sax player. But and I've written a lot of music, but nobody's interested in them. I mean, I wrote like a couple songs for Anita Baker. I wrote a couple songs for Grover. And then what happened was, like when I was going around as a songwriter, I didn't like these people in the record business. They were horrible people, man. It was just so fucked up. They were ignorant and they were just, and I said, you know what? I'll just keep my little songs. When I'm dead, my kids can just, you know, and plus, to be honest with you, I mean, you reach a point where you say, am I saying anything different? Like, you know, what you've done as a musician, what you and Marcus have done, especially for my generation, is that you've taken, and Grover too. You know, I remember talking to Marcus about this. He didn't feel that Grover was, you know, he didn't feel like Grover reached out as far as he was doing. Well, he was right. He's right in that regard. But Grover was the guy who him and what's the guy you like? The guy who played with Ray Charles?
Fathead Newman.
No, not Fathead
no,
Newman.
Jeez,
man.
Hank Crawford.
Hank Crawford. Yeah, Marcus felt that Grover and Hank Crawford sort of parted the forest for him and you to walk through
Oh,
and
absolutely.
push it wide. And I suppose I agree with that, but and I don't know who's making it any wider. This well, actually, there's some cats who are doing good stuff, but there's a certain grit, you know, to the music that you all do now that I can't hear it in other. But again, I'm not listening to that many. Well, I heard Louis Cato's music. I loved it, you know. So it's just not what I'm hearing. So much product, you know. And which well, I'm going to ask you, like, are you still out? Are you touring? Are you playing? You know.
Yeah,
you,
I still go out there. I go out with an acoustic band most of the time. A drummer named Billy Kilson.
Oh man,
you know Billy, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's
Talk about not giving you the one. He'll just.
Oh my God.
But
man.
In a good way.
Yeah,
and Jeffrey Keyser, piano player. I don't know if you know him.
Uh-uh.
And for a long time, played with Ben Williams.
Yeah.
Bass,
Wow.
Bass player Ben.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a trombone player named Michael Dees.
I know who that is. I know who Michael
Yeah,
Dees
yeah.
is.
Pretty much a monster player, you know.
Yeah, man. Now,
so
see,
we did an album that Jonathan Duckett is mixing now, that I think is good because it kind of, you know, I wrote a tune about the first club I ever played in St. Louis called The Other Side, kind of gave me my start. And
yeah.
anyway, there's a lot of autobiographical stuff in there, tuned by Mike Brecker, and you know, and I try. I'm still stuck in that the idea that there's an album that has a beginning and an end, and there's got to be a narrative arc, not only within the tunes themselves, but overall the way you sequence a record. And I know that's kind of an antiquated idea now, but I just want to, because all the records that I grew up with and loved, it was like geographic. They took you someplace that you wanted to be and spend some time for a while. Like I just went to, let's say I would think to myself, I just went to Hank Crawford land, you know, and I love that. And it's to me, it's no different than a great book. I mean, and I read, you know, I read you and I, you know, there's definitely a kind of improvisatory element to you know, because some of the dialogue and the prose is like, it's so lyrical, and it's just like, you know, I almost picture him as like you sitting there going, oh, okay,
yeah, that's it's in the air. I remember there was a guy named Zach Alfred, he's a drummer, and we were in a session, and the producer said, "Can you do that again?" And Zach said, "He said it was in the air. I mean, you know, no." So a lot of times when you, sometimes the only relief I get, frankly, man, is to write books, man. I mean, life is so painful that the only relief I get is to just sit down and create characters that I like or I like to spend time with.
Yeah.
You know, in that regard, that's the only reason why I like to rehearse sometimes. The few rehearsals I do, because I get a chance to talk to musicians and I love to talk. And that, you know, musicians are great to talk to. They're funny. They do stupid shit. I mean, they just, you know, and I miss that, you know, and now I'll say that that's the difference between writers and musicians, unless it's an Irish writer. Like, you know, an Irish writer, man, they're a lot of fun to be. They laugh all the time, man. They're just having a good time. I don't know what it is, man, but they're lowlifes like me. They just like to laugh.
I think it's just that lyrical sense, that sense of poetry and lyricism and you know, I mean, I don't know. I think that's really what it is. I mean, I, especially lately, I've been enjoying my life so much more. I wake up in the morning and I feel happy. I look out and I feel like I experience the world in a way that I never appreciated before, because I see what a miracle all this is. I mean, it's a miracle. There's so much pain and there's so much gratuitous cruelty in the world. But in spite of that, there's just such great beauty. And somehow, like, being able to live with those two realities is, you know, that's the job every day.
This has been As We Speak, hosted by the late David Sanborn. His conversation with James McBride will continue on the next episode.